Classic Rock 102.9 MGK. He is coming to town October 11th at the Scottish Rite Auditorium in Collingswood, New Jersey. Tickets will be available through Ticketmaster.com. The he we are talking about is the host and the entire act on the Grumpy Old Rockstar Tour. Rick Wakeman is joining us this morning. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Yeah, it's all me.
Yeah, that's it. This show is just you.
Yeah, cheap as you like. Yeah, it's just me. It's something I've been doing in England for 30-odd years,
but it's evolved and changed.
And it started in a strange way. Its history goes back to Costa Rica, would you believe? I was doing a show in Costa Rica, went over with my band, and we're all there, and my band arrived, and I arrived, the crew arrived, and the equipment didn't. It got held up in Mexico, and we couldn't get it up there. And the promoter in Costa Rica, I said, we can't play. You know, there's nothing we can do. We'll just have to go home. He said, no, you will play. I said, well, I can play with no equipment. He said, if you don't play, he said, they will kill you. I said, well, he said, oh, no, they will kill you. Some have come a long way from other islands. They will kill you. You will not get out alive. And I said, no, you're joking. He said, seriously, you will play. He said, we have a grand piano in the theatre. He said, you can play that. And I said, well, I think people who've come to hear a prog rock show are not going to be overwhelmingly, you know, sitting down and doing Liberace for half an hour. And he said, you do it. So what we did with the audience is absolutely true. It wasn't an enormous theatre, held about 4,000 or something like that. And we said, obviously he said in Spanish, because I can't speak Spanish, basically the equipment hadn't arrived. I was going to do a show playing the music on the piano. If anybody wanted their money back, they could get it back, or they could stay for the first half. And if at halftime they'd, you know, say, no, this is not for us, they could have their money back and go. And I was happy with that, how it worked. And four people went, that was all.
Wow.
And one of those was pregnant. And I don't know who the others were, but there was one, a woman and her husband, she decided to start having the baby, so she left. and I don't know who the other two were. But it was amazing. And my band, who were there watching, said, you got to do this more often, because I got to go on stage to translate for me. And I tell stories of, because nearly everything I've written and been involved with has been on the piano. So it was like bringing it back to, hey, this is how it was done, this is it. And I took it to England and started doing the show with telling ludicrous stories. I mean, really stupid, because nothing normal's ever happened to me, as you know. So I used to tell these stupid stories and things, all had a sort of modicum of truth to them. And they started doing those with the music in between. And they became really, really popular in the UK. I mean, I don't do hundreds of thousands.
What were you doing? Didn't you do some sort of like Christmas show with John Anderson? Because he was telling us about a show that he did with you. And then in the middle of it, you would just start telling the stories. And he was not prepared for it.
No, that was John and I did a tour together. We did an album called The Living Tree, which was great fun, a sort of an acoustic album. And we went out and we did two tours of the UK, and in between we did a tour of America with it, just as a duo, which was hilarious. And John, he said, what should we talk about between each of the pieces? He said, shall I tell him about my lyrics?
Went, no, not really.
I was hoping for it.
Not really.
I wanted to hear that.
And I said, no, I think we'll pass on that, John. I said, he said, well, what do we do then? I said, look, you just start talking and I'll interrupt you. And that's what we did. So he started talking, going, I wrote this song. And I'd go, not interested, John. And I'd go on and say, I'd say something like, ever been bitten by a dog? And he'd go, what? And it was hilarious. And he was great. He loved it because John's got a great sense of humour. And then what I used to try and do is, just before we started a piece, I'd try and do it so that, because he had a good laugh on him, that he couldn't stop. You know, so some of the pieces, the introduction lasted, well, as a lot of Yes pieces do anyway, about 25 minutes waiting for him to come in and sing. but we did have fun, and it was just, and it worked really well. It was hilarious. But there's so many things, you know, when you've been doing it for so long, so many things have happened, and they are funny. They may not have been funny at the time, But they are funny.
Well, it is. I mean, you know, talk about doing it for so long. Because I remember some time back, you were going to be on the show, and we were going to talk about some stuff. I said, let me go check on something. And it was like the albums you had done, whether it was with Yes or on your own. And, you know, and the list was friggin' endless. And then there was a complete separate list that was just pipe organ albums.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, you had like, at that time, maybe 17 or 20 different pipe organ albums.
Yeah. You know, yeah. I mean, I like diversifying a lot. And I've done all sorts of things, apart from the sessions for loads of other people as well. I've done church organs, I've done theatre organ albums, I've done obviously prog albums, piano albums, harpsichord. Did one harpsichord album. You know, I'll as long as I'm doing music and I'm having fun, music or comedy, I'm happy as a Larry. You know, that's how it works.
Now, but this, you've got a new album coming out. Is and the reason why I was talking about the count here is, have you put out a Christmas album before, or are you eventually now getting to one?
I did Christmas many, many years ago, which sort of appeared, but it didn't do anything, simply because of the reason that in the UK, Christmas is, it's the same old songs that come out year
after.
It's
not much different this year, really, here.
It's
sung by different people, but it's the same damn song.
It's the same thing.
Unless it's REO Speedwagon. Kevin Cronin and them just put out the same album every year.
Yeah.
And then they try to come on for interviews. Sorry, we've done this interview before, Kev. Thanks, though.
We've done it more than once.
Well, I mean, you listen to the radio at Christmas, and I love Christmas. I really do. But you listen to the radio, and you've got everything from, you know, your Mary's Boy Child to it's Christmas and Merry Christmas Everybody and all, and then you'll have the choir from the King's College Cambridge.
Right.
To be honest with you, you do not have to be the greatest radio programmer to do Christmas in England. one of those. And it was the idea actually of Sonny Classical, who I signed to, and a lady there called Sarah Thwaites, who's head of Sonny in the UK, and she called me in for a meeting and said, why don't you do a piano album of Christmas songs? And I said, piano? She said, yeah, like you've been doing the other, because I did two other piano albums, one called Piano Portraits, one called Piano Odyssey. We said, well, you do variations on all of the tunes and the themes. No lyrics, no words, no choirs, nothing else, just piano playing around with all of the. And I thought, that's quite a good idea. So I put it together. We finished it. It's mixed and mastered. It comes out November the 29th. And I'm really pleased with it. And some of the stations in the UK have already heard it. Absolutely love it. They said, there is nothing else like it. We've been looking. This is something else we can slot in now. You know, we can.
But are you doing all those songs that everybody else does?
No. Yes, it's all the song. But let's put it this way. There's 22 Christmas songs, all instrumental. All with different variations on them, into 14 tracks. You will recognize all the songs, but you would have to be somewhat ill to be able to sing along. There is no way you could sing along with any of these unless you were seriously, you know, in need of psychiatric help.
Well, years ago, and tell me if this is sort of what you're doing. Years ago, you played a version of Eleanor Rigby, done by Prokofiev.
I still do that.
Right. And you did it in the studio for us.
Yeah.
Is this what this album's kind of like, that when you're saying variations?
Yeah, I do variations. There's not a Prokofiev one, but there's a few that are a bit weird. But it really does work. It's called Christmas Portraits. But things like, as you say, the Eleanor Rigby. I love doing stuff in the style of other composers. And I still do Eleanor Rigby to this. I'm doing it on this tour. Yeah.
Okay. Now, you have played with numerous people. You've done so much on your own. You've done, everybody knows your work with Yes. I never realized that you were on Space Oddity.
Yeah, that was the first thing I did with David. Yeah.
All right. And you're on the Mellotron on that?
Yeah.
All right. You know, a lot of people do not understand that instrument. They just know that it exists.
Most of the people who played it didn't understand it. It was great for what it did, but it was a bit of a disaster. What it basically was an instrument that had a lot of loop tapes made into loops, that had a note recorded on it. Most of the violins or trumpets. So they'd record a note, put it into a loop. It ran for 8 seconds. And they looped all these things in a big frame inside this instrument. When in simplistic terms, when you hit a note, it pushed a playback head against
the
tape, and it would play the note for 8 seconds and then went and cancel. Which was difficult because if you were playing three or four notes, you'd get da 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 da. And things like that. And it was, and then the other problem was because it was motorized, of course.
Right.
The more notes you pressed down, the slower the motor got. So you'd have a note that'd start off going da and it go da, and they were a nightmare. And there's different ways of playing with the pitch where you could somehow make it sound like in tune, but it had a unique sound. What it was, and David Bowie wanted the Mellotron on Space Oddity. And basically, they were in the studio. Nobody could get it to stay in tune. And Gus Dudgeon, who was producing, Tony Visconti was around as well. And I'd played around with the instrument with Tony Visconti when he was recording a band called Junior's Eyes, which I did quite a few bits for. And Tony said, I know a guy who'll keep it in tune. And I got a call. Can you get up to try the studios quick? To do a Mellotron session. I said, oh, I set fire to it, if you like. So I went up there and David said, can you keep it in tune? I said, yeah, I can do that. So we ran through it. We recorded it live. And that's how Space Oddity came about. And then after that, David just said, I've heard some of your piano playing, which I really like. Do you want to do some piano stuff on the David Bowie album, which over here I think became the Space Oddity album.
Yes, right.
You know, and I did that, and Wild Eyed Boy from Free Cloud, and a few others, and then we moved on to the Hunky Dory album of things. Yeah, great friend.
All right. I mean, how well did you know him? And give me a favorite David Bowie story, because I gave you mine.
I've got a few David Bowie stories. Because apart from all the work and stuff that I did with him, right through to the beginning of Ziggy. We both lived in Switzerland at one stage. We both lived up a mountain above Montreux. Mind you, if you live in Switzerland, you have to live up a mountain. You haven't any choice, really. And we were both up there. It was great, actually, because the mountain, it was full of expats, English expats. There was David Niven, the actor. He was up there. There was Charlie Chaplin was there. David Bowie was there. I was the only person there I didn't know. It was just full of so many well-known people.
Roger Moore?
I'm sure he did.
Yeah, I know he was up there.
He was around there. And Petula Clark, she was a bit further down in Geneva. Anyway, there was a club in Montreux called the Museum Club. And David and I used to meet there regularly during the late 70s and talk. And one of my favourite David stories, we'd put the world to right at all times. And there was one situation where he'd had a bit of a contretemps with his management, and there'd been a few strange things going on, and he was fed up because he'd been taken for quite a lot of money on his boat. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'm fed up. He said, I don't think capitalism works. And I said, well, so what do you think, communism's the answer? He said, well, maybe I'll give it a try. And the great thing about David... The great thing about David was he hated could-haves. Anybody who said, oh, I could have done that, he hated them. He liked doers. If you wanted to know what it was like to walk down a high street wearing a ball gown, he'd do it. Uh-huh. That's what he did, just to find out what it was like. So I knew he wasn't joking, and off he went to East Berlin, and he lived in East Berlin for 6 months, just like the East Berliners with all of the thing. And when he came back after about 6 months, he called me up and said, I'm going down the Museum Club. I went, okay. So I went and joined him down there. And I'll have to clean this up a bit. And I said, well, he went, well, that's not the answer either. And we went, right, okay. And off we moved to something else. He was a real doer. I loved him to bits.
Now, weren't you asked to be in his band, and on that same day, you were asked to join Yes?
Yeah, I was to join Yes. Wow. I'd been to a rehearsal with Yes to decide whether we liked each other. In fact, it was at that rehearsal that we wrote most of Roundabout. We put that together, which was interesting. Wow. And I left at 6. I said, I'm meeting David and Mick Ronson as well. They wanted to meet me at a Hampstead club in Hampstead. And so I went along there, and David was there dressed. Funny enough, he had a dress on. And so did Mick. They were both, but it was normal. They were just, they loved to shock, do, you know, this is what I fancy doing. This is what I'll do. And I loved them for it. And And we sat there, and David said, "Look, I'd been on a Ziggy track and things." He said, "I'm putting the band together, Spiders from Mars." And he said, "Which I'd like you and Mick to front and run it and do all the music. We'll use the rest of the guy, Woody and Trevor, and that." And he says, "How do you feel about that?" And I went, "Ah." And he said, "What's the R?" And I said, "What? I've just been asked to join Yes the same day." And he said, "Well, you've got a bit of thinking to do." And I went, "Yeah." He said, "Well, make a decision and come back." And we actually did a couple of songs on the stage. There was a stage there, and Mick and myself and David went up and did a couple of the songs from Hunky Dory. I can't remember which two we did, but we did a couple of songs. And on the drive home, I was thinking, and I thought, you know, David's the most influential person I've ever worked with. I admire him immensely. I've learnt so much from him. I love his music. His songwriting is sensational. I love what he does. That's going to be pretty cool to be playing that music. But there's a ceiling as to how far I can go.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm playing David's music, there's very, very little input that you can put into apart from the style. So there's a ceiling of how far you can go. And David was miles bigger than Yes were at the time. But I thought, well, Yes, this is a band that's growing. We've talked about they want to go more down the orchestral rock side of things, which is something that I want to do and interests me. And I can grow with that with that band. So that was the natural choice. So I told David, and he went, "Great, you've done the right thing." And in fact, years later, in the later 70s, again at the famous Museum Club in Montreux, the subject came up because David had just put another new band together. And he said, "You made absolutely the right decision in every stretch of the imagination." And he said, "Look," he said, "you know, I changed musicians." He always brought in musicians that he felt understood what he was trying to do.
Uh-huh.
And because he said to me, "Do that whenever you're doing your solo stuff. Get people in, not just because they're friends or whatever, get them in who you think, they'll understand what I'm getting at. So you don't have to try and explain what you're getting across." And he said, "So I've always done that." He said, "So who knows, Rick, you may have been out of a job by now."
Cool. You've played with a lot of people, and one of the things that always interests me is when keyboard players play with keyboard players. How did you end up working with Elton John?
I've got great respect for Elton John. I think he's one of the great songwriters of all time. And sometimes that overshadows the fact that he's a good piano player.
Mm-hmm.
He's a really good piano player. But we used to meet a lot because we both were soccer fans. I was the director of a London club called Brentford, and he was the chairman of a club just outside London called Watford. And they were in the same division and used to play it. So we used to meet up and we used to obviously talk at these games. And he said to me that he was going in to do Mabon across the water. And he said, "I hate playing the organ." He said, He said, "Well, do you fancy coming along and doing the organ?" I said, "Yeah, I'd love to." And the reason he didn't like playing the organ was because his fingers were not fat, but they're quite wide fingers, great for playing the piano, but not good for the organ because if you overlapped keys and things, it was
sure.
He didn't like that. And he said, "I don't like playing the organ. Would you come and do it?" And I went, "I'd love to." So we did it at Trident Studios, and he had the full orchestra in there because those are the days when you were all in there together recording. And it was great fun. And then we did a show. He did one show at the Royal Festival Hall, which I did with him on the organ. Big band, orchestra, choir. Great fun. And I think the world of Elton. I've got a lot of respect for him. And I took a bit of a leaf out of his book as well, because I will never play an instrument on an album if there's somebody who can play it better.
Oh, wow.
So that pretty much means everything except for the keyboards. You know, I'm not a great fan of somebody comes and says, "Oh, I played every instrument on this album." I go, that good are you? You know.
Now, of keyboards, if you were to say, you know, this one is my instrument, which one is it? Is it piano? It's piano?
Yeah.
Okay.
Piano.
And that's where you started too, right? Because all classical
as
a child.
Yeah, I did all my classical training and did my degree and what a lot. That's what I did. I love the piano. I absolutely love the piano because it's the most tactile of all of the instruments.
Uh-huh.
Because however you stroke or play the keys, that's what you get back. It's amazing. I mean, there were some great... I mean, I love my electronic keyboards and things. Bob Moog was a great friend. And what Bob Moog did to you know, to, for
he
keyboard.
Was a professor at my college.
Was he really?
When he invented the synthesizer.
Oh, wow.
And we used to break into his studio at night so we could just go and screw with it.
Oh,
all right, you know?
Bob was absolutely wonderful. I mean, I loved Bob to bits. He was an amazing character. And he gave keyboard players the instrument to die for, because up until then, if you're in a band, okay, you had an organ, you know, like either a Pfizer or a, if you're very lucky and could afford it, a Hammond, or, you know, you had a Vox Continental, that kind of thing.
Sure.
That's what you had. And the problem was that even amplified, you could hardly hear them. And you were always the lesser in the band. I mean, the band would be steaming away. The guitarist would do a great solo. And then they'd all have to come down to a really low level while the poor old organ keyboard and electric player had to try and thumb something. And everybody, they used to look across cynically at the guitarist. Oh, isn't it a shame? And then Bob came up with the Moog that would cut through concrete. And I remember when I first got, I mean, Steve won't mind me saying, but I remember when I first got it and it came to a solo. And, of course, Steve, because Tony Kay used to play the organ, if it didn't play since, it came to a solo thing, you know, and I hit the Moog, the Mini Moog, which cut through concrete. I mean, the look of absolute horror on Steve and Chris's face. It was, Jesus, loud as we are. You know, and it was absolutely brilliant. And I loved him for that, because that gave us, it opened everything up for keyboard players. It really did.
Now, there was at that time, or not too long after, there was another keyboard. I can't remember what the keyboard was called, but it was, I remember the guy who created, a guy named David Friend. Right, and I'm trying to remember what the hell that keyboard was, but it was also a synthesizer.
Yeah.
But it was more advanced than the Moog was at the time, because Moog still had that little ribbon on the keyboard to make the slidey sounds. But I damn if I can remember what that was called.
I don't know. I probably would know if you said it. But no one's ever been able to come up with an instrument that actually sounds like a Moog. They are phenomenal. Mm-hmm. But there was all the synthesizers, all those companies did really well, and companies like Korg and Roland and Kurtz.
Well, the new Korgs are just
they're
incredible.
Sensational. Well, it's interesting with Korgs. the late Carter Sound, who was the head of Korg, was a great, great friend. He was a marvelous character. But he invited me over to Tokyo in the late 70s. Actually, it's the early 80s, to be fair. And I went to see him and he, in his office, they were making keyboards, but mainly for schools, for children's stuff. And he told me the story of how they started in, it's a company called K Electronics. And one night, he was a good man, Kato-san. He was always the first in and last to leave, a real typical...
Kind of like me, guys.
Yeah.
Kind of like me.
Yeah. No.
Whatever.
Oh, boy.
And that door frame's not that big, dude. Get that big-ass head out of here.
He told me he was leaving one night, and he saw one guy working at one of the benches. He said, which they're allowed to. And he went down and said, what are you doing? And he'd built a little one-octave keyboard. When you played the note, it sounded like a wasp breaking wind kind of thing. And he'd made it for his son, for his birthday. And Carter-san was fascinated with this and said, I want to make more of these. So they developed the things, which started off really as school things.
Uh-huh.
But then Kato-san realized that keyboards hadn't really developed apart from what Bob Moog had done.
Mm.
You know, they were still, you know, pretty much in their infancy what they were doing. Nobody had really got to grips with them. So he brought in a whole research team. And I remember in his office, he said, Korg at the moment, 16 in the world. I want to be number one. And he developed a load of instruments, and he wanted me to take them on tour to try them out. I said, okay. So I took them all on tour, and they were fantastic. And what he did, and he was right, 1 year later, they were number one.
Wow.
And he was so fascinated with keyboards. I mean, he was a very funny guy, Kato-san. I mean, he used to play tricks. I remember going to a restaurant with him, and there was sort of like at the entrance there where the maitre d' was waiting. This was in Tokyo, and there was nobody there. And we just stood there, and the phone rang, and he just picked up the phone. Went, and put the phone down. And the people who were with us from Korg, they go, oh, no. And then the maitre d' comes back and takes us to our table. And I said to one of the guys, what did he say? He said it was somebody trying to book a table, and he told him, "Don't bother, the food's crap." And he did things like this all the time. He was, I loved him to bits. But I did one thing with him that I'm very, very, actually quite proud of. It was at, like you have your the big sort of trade fair out out on the West Coast. They have one in Germany. In Frankfurt, the Frankfurt Fair, it's basically the West Coast were moved to
the NAMM convention.
It's NAMM goes to Frankfurt, and I was out there one year, and Bob Moog, Moog had gone, but he was doing the theremin, which was that.
Oh wow,
that weird instrument.
Right. Yeah,
he was there on with his theremin stand. And Korg had a massive stand, and they had a big sort of Winnebago for guests, which is where Kato-san was in. And I went to see Bob, and we had a chat about things. And he wasn't in great health then, because he hadn't been diagnosed then, but he had a brain tumor, and he wasn't himself. But it was lovely as always to talk to him. So. He said, "Well, who else are you going to see?" I said, "I'm going to see Kato-san at Korg." He said, "Great man, Kato-san, all that he's done." And I said, "I know." I said, "You must know him." He said, "No, I've never met him." I said, "Well, come over with me, see Kato-san." He said, "Oh, no." He said, "He won't know who I am." I said, "Bob, are you off your head?" He said, "No, he won't know. I'm not going." So I went down to the Korg thing. I went in the Winnebago, saw Kato-san. And we're talking, and Kato's, he didn't speak great English, so through a lovely lady called Junko used to translate, and Junko said, "Well, where Kato-san wants to know where you've been." I said, "I've just been down with Bob Moog," and he heard the name. He went, "Oh, Bob Moog," and he sort of stood up and did a bowing motion.
Right.
He said, Bob Moog," and I said to Junko, I said, "He must have met Bob Moog," and he said, "No, never met." I went, "Right, hold on, I've had enough of this." So I went out and I went and got Bob. I said, "Bob, come with me." I went, "Where are we going?" I said, "Come with me." And I dragged him along the aisle to the Winnebago, took him on and took him into the Winnebago. And Kato-san stood up and they both looked at each other. And I just didn't know what to do. And I said, "Dr. Bob Moog, this is Kato-san. Kato-san, this is Bob Moog." And they just grinned and gave each other the biggest hug ever. And then they sat down, I left, and Junko told me later, they talked for about 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
So if there's anything that I can be proud of in the keyboard world, it was introducing probably the two most important people in rock music as regards keyboards.
Now, I've got a question that I don't even know how it came about, and that's why I've got to ask it. When you were with Yes, and especially when you were deep in Yes,
yeah.
Right, you know, everybody came out in their, you know, whatever clothes they were going to wear, and you know, and John came out in whatever clothes he was going to wear after he got out of his little tent, right?
Yeah, the tent,
right?
Yeah,
and you would come out, and you would be a little more glitzy than the others, and you always had a cape on.
Yeah,
what brought the cape along?
Okay, the cape story. Like a lot of great things, it wasn't deliberate. What it was, we were on tour. It was 1971. It was my first tour with Yes, and we were playing anywhere we could. It was the days when there was like four, sometimes five acts on the bill.
Sure,
you
sure.
Know, and you get up. So we were getting on anywhere we could, mostly first act when you know you got 20 minutes or 20 minutes when people were walking in. On occasions, you were second and that kind of thing. And most of the time, we were on the bill where there was... 10 years after, I remember being there. That was one we did a lot, and we played a couple of shows. And of course, you were never mentioned in any reviews in the papers because you're like fifth on the bill,
right?
You know, the journalists probably hadn't even arrived by then. But there was one interview where we got mentioned. Not interview, sorry, a review where we got mentioned, and it was really complimentary. It said that this band, Yes, had come and was really different in every respect, and was certainly one to watch, and was mentioned musicianship and things, and then it was very nice about me. It said, you know, a keyboard player really different with a multitude of keyboards, but with pedals and keyboards on different levels, when he was playing, reaching one from the other, looked like a demented spider. And I thought, you know what? he's right, really. I mean, nobody made keyboard stands back then. They didn't exist. I used to buy chests of drawers in furniture shops, take the drawers out, cut the middle out, and we'd lay the keyboards
on them.
That's what we did, because there were no keyboard stands. I couldn't get anybody to make them. And I kept realizing, because of the keyboards on different heights, the pedals were obviously, because a lot of them were attached to the
keyboard,
were on different heights. So
just picturing it.
There were legs and things going. I mean, I couldn't do it now. I mean, but it was, and we did another couple of shows, and I was really aware of it, you know, and I thought, gosh, it must look really weird. And then we played Hartford, Connecticut. It was a little outdoor festival, a couple of thousand people there, and about 10 bands on or something ridiculous. And we're standing at the side of the stage, and as often happened in the smaller festivals, the jock from the local station would be introducing all of the bands. So we're waiting to go on for our turn. We only had a half hour to play, and he was standing there, and he had a three-quarter length black cape on, and didn't occur to me until he turned round, and he must have been 250 pounds. I mean, he was enormous. But I thought, God, that cape hides a multitude of things. And then I thought, hold on a minute. This is the answer. And we got $200 a week then. That's what we got. And we'd just been paid. And I had 10 $20 bills in my back pocket. And as he came off, I said, I want to buy your cape. And he said, not for sale. And I did the old car dealer's trick. I took it out, fanned it, and I said, this is all I've got. This is my wages, $200. And he looked at it, and he went, yeah, okay. So he's taking the cape off, he's taking the money, I'm putting it on. The band are waiting to play, shouting at me where I... So I walk on with this, well, it was a three-quarter length cape on him, but it was like half-length cape on me. But I went up and played. We did it, came off. And Michael Tate, who's now, like, with Tate Towers, one of the biggest lighting guys in the country. He was doing our lights then and looking after the band. And he came to me after, he said, you've just hit on the answer. He said, but it's not a black half-length cape. You need sequin full-length. And I said, well, where can I buy something like that? He said, I know a girl who will make them for you. And he introduced me to this lovely lady who made me sort of four or five of the classic capes that there are. And he said, you've got to have them glittery because it picks up the lights. He said, but what it will do, all those movements, you won't see them because they'll just be swirling around. So that's how the cape started.
Now let me ask, because I've actually set you up for something. You still have numerous ones of these capes?
I have four of the classic capes.
Right.
Unfortunately, a couple, the Journey to the Center of the Earth cape, that went missing. I've still got a couple of the classic Yes capes, including the big gold and red sequin one, which was all made by hand. Weighs a ton. Uh-huh. But I've still got that. That's great. I've still got the first glittery one that she made for me as well. The interesting thing is, when I do rocks, especially when I go to countries like South America, they write in the contract that you will wear
the cape,
one of the capes, a deal breaker if you don't. Because in the magazines, especially down in Brazil and Argentina, when they show a picture, I say, it's always a picture with the cape. And down there, of course, it's very popular with younger generations, the old prog rock thing. So they've seen the pictures of the cape. So if you don't go down with the cape, it's not you. Yeah. Yeah.
The reason why I'm asking is we do this event every year where we raise hundreds of thousands of dollars for our local veterans group.
Yep.
And with a lot of people, you know, everybody signs guitars for us and we auction those off to help raise more money.
Yep.
And seeing that most of your instruments would be difficult to autograph, sign, and package, all right, I was wondering if you had a cape you didn't care that much for anymore that you would autograph and let us use as an auction item.
I tell you what I do. The classic capes, obviously, they're one-offs.
No, yeah, right.
They are one-off. But what I have done, and I did it for a charity in England, and it made a lot of money. I've got a great friend of mine who runs a company called Stagewear Unlimited, and he is absolutely brilliant. And he did a copy of one of the classic capes, which we auctioned off, and it was all done inside and all done properly, and it was all signed inside as one of one. It's the only, you know, the so there's no other copy, no other one will ever be made, and it raised a lot of money. I'll tell you what, I'll do one of those for. I'm going to make.
Oh, dude, that would be great.
When is it? Next spring.
It's in June.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, drop me an email and everything and remind me, because it takes him about 2 weeks to make it.
Oh, great.
So I'll get him to make one. And I'll get it out. You just tell me when I'll get it over to you.
That'd be great. Awesome. That would be great. So let's get back to this show.
Yeah.
All right. The show on October 11th at the Scottish Rite Auditorium. All right. What are you going to play? Are you going to do Six Wives stuff? Are you going to do Yes stuff? Are you going to do, you know, some of this Christmas stuff? What's going to be there?
I don't do the Christmas stuff. It's still a little bit too far away from Christmas. Although on the
you're close to Halloween. You got anything spooky?
He's got an orange shirt on.
Yeah, that's true. What I might do on the very last show, which is not this one, which is right at the end of October, I might finish off if I do an encore. I might do a Christmas one at then. Say this is, you know, way in advance. Uh-huh. But no, you're right. I do some of my own stuff as it was all written. I do some yes songs as instrumentals. They all work great as instrumentals. And I do some Bowie stuff. I do Cat Stevens stuff. I've done a couple of albums where I've taken well-known songs and done them variations of, which have been, I'm pleased to say, have been hugely successful in the UK, you know, both top 10 albums. And I take some Beatles stuff because, as you said, like Eleanor Rigby, because the tunes are so great. You can play around and you can do anything with them. And that's the secret with a good tune. And then so I do all of those. And then in between, as I say, tell ridiculous stories about things that have happened to me in my life or things that are likely to be happening to me in my life. And they change quite a lot. I mean, I change the stories around a bit because so many different things happen. And I say in England, it was always quite easy to do because you tell a story about, you know, the previous marriage you'd had.
Right.
And then by the time you came to the next story, it would be the previous marriage that you just have that time around. So you could have an awful lot of fun. So about people you know and people you've met. And it's interesting, most of the stories, if not all of them, are self-deprecating. Because that is what life is all about. You know,
right, if you can't laugh at you,
no,
don't
right.
bother laughing at all.
I mean, I've had... It's interesting how I did two books, one called Grumpy Old Rockstar and another one called Further Adventures of a Grumpy Old Rockstar. and they came about a little bit because of I was asked to do them after the Grumpy Old Men programs. But I had a great friend. There's an actor, you won't know him over here, called Duncan Preston. He's a big comedy actor. And I'd just come back from Russia. This is in 1979, 1980, you know, well... pre the Berlin Wall coming down and communism collapsing. I used to go over and do piano recitals. And I got into quite serious trouble there. I got arrested for stealing a KGB uniform. And I was in unbelievable trouble. I was arrested at Moscow airport and there was no diplomatic relations between them. And I must admit, I was seriously worried. Because you suddenly realize, I'm in all trouble now. And I thought, I'm on my way to Siberia here. This is really bad news. And I was allowed to make one phone call from Finnair, from the Finland desk, because they were sort of like the neutrality of any problems. And I remember phoning my wife, which number was that at the time? Number 3. I phoned up number 3, and that wasn't her name, but that's...
Right.
I'm just trying to put things in. And I said, and she answered the phone, and she said, well, I said, I've been arrested. She said, what? I said, I'm in Moscow. I've been arrested for stealing a KGB uniform. And she said, well, I'm getting dinner for the kids, and put the phone down. So I'm sort of stuck there. And the guy, I was saved. This is absolutely true. I was saved by this guy who'd arrested me, this KGB guy, because he just suddenly said, it is very hard to get Yes albums here and your own albums. And I said, I'll get you anything you want. Whatever you name, I'll get it to you. So basically I did a deal there as soon as I got back to ship out, which I did. I shipped a load of albums and a load of stuff over to him, which he got. And he said, "Okay, I'll get you through with the uniform." And I said, you're not going to take it? He said, no, you can keep it. You go through. So he said, the good thing is, he said, when you go, they used to go through eight different customs to get
right,
out
right.
there. He said, I will stop them opening your bag. He said, that even when it goes through the photo, the x-ray, he said, it won't show up because, he said, there are no shiny badges on the KGB uniform. And he went, you have gone very quiet. I said, there's a lot of shiny badges on the Admiral's uniform. And he said, you have an Admiral's uniform? And he went, and then he said a rude word in English. And he said, okay, we do what we can. And he got me through. And I got home with all of this. And I was telling this to my friend Duncan. I just got back. And he is howling with laughter. And I said, Duncan, it is not funny. I was in such a mess. I could be in Siberia now. I could be locked away. I could be forgotten about for the rest of my life and all that. And he said, no, I'll tell you why it's funny, Rick. Yeah, I can understand why you must have been terrified at the time. He said, but you are here in front of me telling the story. He said, you're telling the story in front of me, so I know that it has a happy ending because you're here.
Right.
So therefore,
it's
funny. I told it on a chat show in the UK. It's on YouTube, actually, the chat show. If you fancy a laugh, it's on Danny Baker After All, it's called. Danny
okay.
Baker After All. If you put Danny Baker After All, Rick Wakeman, KGB uniform, it comes up. Most of it's on there. But he was dead right. But if you see, if somebody has a story that's disastrous, about how they fell out of a 15-story on the 15th floor of a large building, you know, and landed in a rose bush. You know, if somebody else told you the story, you go, "Oh, were they all right? Did they hurt?" But because you're there telling it,
right.
they know
it's
all right.
It's fine. Yeah.
And that's the basis of most of the stories that I tell.
Well, now that we have an understanding of what the stories are like, are you willing to give us an understanding of what the music is like? Because as I have done to you before, there happens to be a keyboard in the studio,
oh,
right,
okay.
over there, all right? So would you mind
doing a little
something? But not Eleanor Rigby. I already have that recorded.
No, I won't.
Got headphones for you if you need them.
As long as you've got a pedal.
Right. There's no pedal.
I tell you what.
Well, here's the thing. Just hit a couple keys. That thing was heavy, and I carried that in the studio. I was sweating before the interview.
It is. And this is not being... It's not giving you an excuse. It's almost impossible to do anything without...
I've got headphones if you want them.
Yeah, it might be helpful because I can only
can't hear them.
There you go. It's very hard to do anything without a pedal. Sustained.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, these are two drummers, and I don't know anything about music, so that's why we don't have a pedal.
There could be a sustained pedal in Shoes' room.
I didn't see it.
It would be on the floor.
It wasn't on the floor. Other than me trying to pull the friggin' plug out of here, moving things around.
Have you got a pedal hidden anywhere?
I mean, hold on. Let me go right into the studio.
S-shoes.
I just need to sustain
S-shoes.
That's all. Yeah, you honestly, it's almost impossible to do anything.
Steve, it's hysterical because Dave and I, we are both drummers, but we've been in bands. We've been playing music. Steve has never touched an instrument in his life. So we'll start getting into things, and Steve is like, what do you mean you need a sustain pedal?
Yeah, Steve's the jock of the show.
Yeah, he's the jock.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, it's the equivalent of...
No sustain pedal.
No sustain
what
pedal.
What is this, a radio station in a major market?
The difficulty is the equivalent... As your drummers, right?
Right, yeah. Right, right.
I'll speak very slowly.
Please. Simple analogies.
Yeah, I'll keep it in one and two syllable words.
Please.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
It's the equivalent of you being given a drum kit. And there's no pedal for the bass drum.
Right? Oh, no kick drum. Yeah, that would be a problem.
Kick drum, and no pedal for the hi-hat.
Oof, yeah.
And one stick.
That's going to be a crap beat.
Well,
it's going to be a bit tricky.
Yeah.
Well, let's put it this way. Let's put this.
I'm trying to see if there's anything I can play. I can't think.
That sounds good to me.
This is Rick's song called
Yeah, I don't know anything about it. So listen, that's the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
It gets worse. There must be something. There isn't anything really that...
doesn't require a sustain pedal.
Because what the sustain pedal does, obviously, is you hit something, hit the sustain pedal, and it keeps the note going while you're doing something else. So without that, it is a bit tricky. So I've just got these fingers and
I mean, I'm sort of limited to 11, well, 10 or 11.
You have 11 fingers?
But there is a way of doing it when you're standing up. This way.
And there's the perfect ending.
Wow.
There isn't really. I am sorry.
No, it's okay.
That sounded pretty impressive to me.
Listen, if there's one thing that this show is, it's unprepared. So we're perfect.
Yeah. Just, well, I'll give you an ending anyway.
Perfect.
Classic Rock 102.9 MGK. It's the Grumpy Old Rock Star Tour coming to the Scottish Rite Auditorium in Collingswood, New Jersey on Friday, October 11th. Tickets are available at Ticketmaster.com. Rick Wakeman, our guest. Thank you so much, David.
Oh, thank you very much. And I'll as well as sending you a cape, I'll send you a sustained plate. So next time I come in, I can.
Classic Rock 102.9 MGK.
Hi, this is Rick Wakeman, and here, yes, it's me, John Anderson, and you're listening to The John DiBella Show on Classic Rock 102.9 MGK.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.